content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book by Margaret Roach, A Way to Garden, a hands-on primer for every season. And we will begin with the chapter called Adulthood, which is for July and August gardening. And we left off last time with Fall Vegetable Garden. And I'll just read the beginning of that again and then continue with the rest. In July and even August, after the longest day has passed, I make sowings in my northern garden of crops that will come to harvest in fall. Though summer is coming on strong, I am thinking about fall too. Here's where the math of days to maturity listed on the seed packets need a bit of adjusting. Though, since these estimates are based on spring sowings, when temperatures and hours and intensity of light are strengthening, not declining. What to do to adjust for what is often referred to as the fall factor, counting back from the first expected frost date of fall and adding 2 weeks, some say closer to three, to the time that the crops will be expected to reach maturity. Remember that with some crops, the days to maturity are calculated from the moment seed is sown, while with others, it's from transplant time. So you have to figure in the time it takes to produce a seedling, too. It's hard to get it exact, so I err on the side of starting earlier, but not so early that I subject these generally cool season plants to too much summer heat. For best results, select varieties bred for or useful at the target time of year. You'll want a storage carrot, for instance, for winter use, plus a carrot for fresh fall eating. So a cold, tolerant lettuce, latest of all, versus one whose outstanding trait is standing up to heat without bolting, or in general, shorter day varieties of everything. Remember to plan not just for the fall table, but also for putting up, like a row of shelling peas to shuck and freeze in a portion-sized bags, or plenty of the ingredients in your favorite soup recipe. Add fall factor weeks to times noted in the following latest sown crops, which include direct sown seeds and also some I started earlier in cell packs. And here's a list that she has of what she sows in her garden. And with the days to maturity. Arugula, 21 to 40 days, baby or mature leaf size. Bush beans, about 60 days. Have insulating fabric ready in early cold if early cold threatens. Beets, for roots and beet greens, about 50 days. Braising greens mix, which is mustard, kale, collards, Asian greens, etc. Broccoli rabi, about 40 days. Broccoli, 60 days from transplant, starting about 15 weeks before the first frost. Cabbage, 60 days from transplants, starting about 15 weeks before first frost, or Napa cabbage, about 10 days faster. Carrots, a storage kind, plus some smaller types for fall eating. Cauliflower, 60 days from transplants, starting about 14 weeks before frost. Chard, about 55 days. Chicory, leaf endive, radicchio, 45 to 60 plus days, depending on the variety. Cilantro, about 50 days. Collards, about 60 days, but nice in half that time as a baby green. Dill, 50 to 60 days. Oh, excuse me. Kale, about 60 days, but nice in half that time as a baby green. Lettuce, leaf and head type, and mesclun mix, about 21 to 30 days to first cutting. Mustard greens, about 45 days, or faster as baby greens to spice a salad. Peas, shelling, sugar snap, and snow pea types, plus a row or block of thickly sown peas for harvest and shoots for salad at 3 or 4 inches tall. Radish, smaller, fast ones, plus larger Asian daikon, is 60 days. Scallions and other hardy bunching and onions for fall use and to overwinter. Spinach, 25 to 30 days. Squash, summer variety, fast bush type. ISO, a 48-day variety on July 1st. Turnips, 40 to 50 days, faster for greens and also rutabagas. When loading up beds with fall harvest crops, leave room for the all-important garlic, which goes in several weeks before frost is in the ground and stays till the following summer. And our next topic is a few good living mulches. Cautionary tale. A manifest destiny approach to making beds and borders around the place as quickly can quickly lead to a spotty set of outdoor features. A grouping of shrubs here, a bed of perennials there, a tree across the way. I'd planted and planted and planted, but frankly, what did it all add up to? It didn't flow until ground covers helped unite elements that otherwise looked like so many disconnected islands. From a prostrate conifer like Siberian cypress or the Japanese plum yew to ornamental grasses or sedges, a vine left to scramble or the tiniest ground-hugging moss, they can all be used as a ground cover if massed or combined into a large area with other plants of a similar scale. Generally speaking, the most successful ground cover is a low-growing plant that fills in quickly to create a continuous cover. The underplanting or ground-level parts of a design that has various other layers above it, up to trees. I even underplant larger shrubs and small trees with lower growing shrubs, such as prostrate golden yew, like a colorful textural ruff. Ground covers act as living mulch, reducing weeding and unshading soil, which offers the shrubs or trees above them a cooler, moister root run. By doing this, ground covers reduce watering requirements compared to bare soil and can camouflage ripening foliage of springtime bulbs interplanted among them, prevent erosion, and camouflage harsh edges like the corner of a porch or deck. I prefer planting ground covers in combination as what I refer to as mosaics, rather than monochromes, as I have mentioned. But sometimes you need the simplicity of wall-to-wall carpet, like in the various large shrub borders at the farther edges of the landscape here. Each mosaic segment may be 750 to 1,000 square feet and containing multiple shrubs. The trick is selecting ground cover that do the living mulch assignment well. Good cover, not a lot of maintenance, without being invasive thugs like some of the first plants I tried back in the day when nobody warned me or knew better. The one I settled on as my workhorse is the big root geranium, so named because instead of a clumping habit, it grows from a rope-like rhizome that seems to barely need to touch the ground to thrive. It spreads, but is easy to just pull up and does not seed here. Its attractive weed-suppressing foliage has an aromatic spicy scent and is nearly evergreen, even in Zone 5B. It seems to tolerate sun or shade, and even dry shade, but not a wet spot, requiring just an annual haircut. Shear with hedge clippers or a pruner. The former is faster for big masses. Timed right after bloom. Deadheading would be another option, but shearing keeps each the expanse of plants tighter and denser. The straight species is pink-flowered, but not pastel. If Pepto-Bismol makes you queasy, there is the more prim, pale pink Ingerson's variety, and even white Album. Epimedium is expensive to get started with, but then offers loads of divisions once established. The same can be said for Helleborus orientalis or H. hybridus, which make many seedlings once they get going that are good for relocating to extend the planting. Both are semi-evergreen, the old foliage fading before the new arrives. I use a lot of Heconecloa, a graceful shade grass, too. On a semi-shady, steep bank above the backyard, shrubs like Microbiota and Cephalotaxis, and also the northeast native lowbush blueberry, do the job. In recent years, the native woodlander, Acerum canadense, a herbaceous ginger, is one perennial I am moving into wider areas of coverage, as is sturdy Huchera villosa, a southeastern native, but perfectly hardy in my zone and offering easily transplanted seedlings. Autumn Bride is a popular form, and since it blooms similarly late, I like it combined with white wood aster, Eurybia divaricata. They both live under Aronia melancarpa, a chokeberry that's native to the east in semi-shade. Or plant ferns, loads of ferns. One of the most striking ground cover plantings I ever saw was ferns in the woodland at ancient Powys Castle in Wales. As I came upon the glade, it looked as if the ferns were in flower, which, of course, ferns do not do, since they predate the evolution of flowering plants, the angiosperms. It was a colony of species, lilies interplanted in the mass of ferns, a memorable sight indeed. And remember that she is talking about the zone is colder than North Carolina. She's in New York. And our next topic is meadow plants, mowing strategies. I'd been mowing a couple of acres regularly for years when I suddenly had one of those aha moments, realizing how many hours and gallons of fuel I had wasted. Allowing the grass to grow up to field height right around the house wasn't practical, but in the outer areas a change might be fun. The hilly acre above the backyard was the first target. I had visited Madison, Wisconsin, where some forward-thinking gardeners, called the Wild Ones, had long-timed their mowings to encourage prairie-like meadows instead of close-cropped lawns. I had also traveled to England, where selective mowing is an art form that complements the more formal beds and borders of noted gardens. The sensual texture of unmown grass against the cropped green paths cut through, it invites movement through the landscape. But what would sprout in my hillside if I stopped subduing it? The first step in deciding not to mow, or rather when to selectively mow, is an evaluation of the resident plants. At the start of claiming this place, I had fought my way through a tangle on the hillside, the remnants of former forage crops meant for a cow long gone, and every manner of thorny invasives like brambles and multiflora rose put oriental bittersweet and an alien honeysuckle. In the mess, there existed a sign of hope in the form of the native bunchgrass called Little Bluestem. Though there were other mostly welcome herbaceous things, from a goldenrod to yarrow and sedges, the bluestem became my target species, the one I'd coddle and favor over the others, the one I designed my mowing strategy around. This plant would teach me many lessons and continues to, including one about the benefits of creative mowing, or unmowing as I think of it. The cheapest, simplest, and most effective thing we can do to increase diversity is to stop, or at least reduce, mowing. Turf grass is dimensionless, supporting no beneficial insect life that in turn supports birds and other wildlife and pollinates plants. In 2015, a Nassau study estimated that nation's total expanse of turf at 163,812 square kilometers, about the size of Texas, and about three times the amount of space allotted to any irrigated crop, corn being the most common. Can't we each find 500 or 5,000 square feet of grass to give back? To give back that first third acre, I began by researching how to favor my target species, which turns out to awaken later than the species I don't care for. I therefore time my mowing around the start of the second week of May, when the undesirable cool season plants are already well up, but just before the blue stem reaches tractor blade height. Given the blue stem and other late plants, the edge, in a few years of once-a-season mowing, I went from having a few stray clumps of blue stem to about 30% coverage and steadily to more than 60%. I mow one other time as early as I can in spring before anything emerges, perhaps the 1st of April, to chop up the debris left behind by winter, which I compost. Then I'll mow at the moment already described. I dig out and discard periodic eruptions of rubus and edit the lustiest of the goldenrod occasionally too. But that's it. In return, and without planting anything, I got a meadow that probably delights me more than any bed or border I have toiled over, and what has proven the second best attraction, after the apparently irresistible water gardens, to the widest diversity of insect, avian, and animal life. Even gray fox and bobcat wait at the edges of the longest grass to pounce on whatever vole or mouse might dare move within. In late summer through winter, the blue stem truly glows from an initial reddish or coppery hue to a warm golden tan. I will never be lawn free, because unlike any other plant, mown grass is great to walk on, allowing us to move through the landscape. More outer areas here are getting unmown each year, though. And I guess that's a good idea, but if you have that much lawn, I don't think too many people have that much unless you're out in the rural areas, which would be great. And our next topic is cutbacks. If it featured spring blooming perennials and bulbs, the garden may have a bad case of what a friend calls the shaggies, unwanted frowsiness that make it look a fright. Add to that the inevitable first few blasts of 90 degree weather, and you probably wonder, is there life after spring or heat stroke? Here is where a shorter haircut, a deep drink, and an adherence to the strategy of the long game help garden and gardener. Being a bit savage with deadheading, shearing, and other cutbacks and aftercare beginning in mid-June, and in smaller bursts throughout the summer, means that my garden can be open for tours in August, and in fact looks quite presentable until it is felled by the late fall freezes. As I tidy up frowsy plants, I top up mulch where needed, and also give any fuzzy stretches of bed edge a crisper cut. I've already tossed the stretched-up violas that filled the big bowl-shaped pots in April and May, and I've begun deadheading any plant whose blossoms just look ratty. But starting around mid-June and into early July, I need to take to some perennials, not with pruning shears, but hedge clippers, the way I used them to make short work of tidying big patches of epimedium in early spring, or at least shop shears, bigger, sturdier versions of craft scissors, with comfortable molded plastic handles. The plants and I will feel much better once we get past 2 or 3 weeks of stubble growing out. I share pulmonaria and the earliest euphorbia like polychroma and various perennial geraniums, hard just after bloom, including not just geranium macrorhizum, but also G. Phaeum, a good choice of shadier spots. Catmint and any artemisia that flowered or in trying to get the treatment, and if I grow perennial salvias, I'd whack them after bloom too. A sentimental old patch of lady's mantle by the vegetable garden gate will before long need to be shorn, plus my most rambunctious ground cover sedum. The wood poppy, or celandine poppy, whose gold flowers shone in the April-May garden, will soon look peaked at its foliage phase. I simply cut each rosette at the base, and a new crop flushes, and even some occasional rebloom is coaxed from this native plant that doesn't naturally range as far east as my garden. These are just examples, by no means the only ones needing a stem hand. If a plant ends up looking wretched, cut it back unless you plan to save seeds. One thing I might deadhead, but I never shear until their foliage has completely faded to tan or the spring blooming flower bulbs. Cutting bulb foliage back too soon doesn't allow the bulb to build up enough nutrients and may sacrifice next year's blooms. Are there other perennials not gone by yet in terms of bloom, but that in previous years got so big they flopped? A preemptive version of cutbacks may be best referred to as pinching by about one half may help Joe Pye weed, for instance, or even some of the taller asters and sedums and garden phlox or bee balm to bloom slightly later than if left to its own. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anadine Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and we hope you'll join us again for another session.